The International Criminal Court has opened the door to investigate war crimes in the Israeli-occupied territories. So will justice finally prevail? I'm Mark Lamont Hill. Also on the show, just months after being poisoned with a deadly nerve agent, Russia's opposition leader Alexei Navalny was sentenced to more than 2.5 years in prison. His supporters, however, continued to protest in thousands, despite a violent crackdown by Vladimir Putin's security forces. Is this a turning point for Russia? That's our debate. But first, a new hope for justice is what some Palestinians have called the International Criminal Court's ruling that gives it jurisdiction over the occupied territories. The Israeli prime minister has slammed it as a, quote, perversion of justice. So are Israeli officials afraid they could be prosecuted for war crimes? I'll ask Israel's former ambassador to the UN, this week's headliner, Danny Danone. Danny Danone, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me today, Mark.
The International Criminal Court ruled last week that it does have jurisdiction to investigate potential crimes within the territories occupied by Israel. Your prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, called it a perversion of justice, and he said that the alleged violations are, quote, fake war crimes. Why discredit any investigation before it even gets started?
Prime Minister Netanyahu was absolutely right. It is a political decision. Israel and the U.S., we are not a member of the international court. And also, when you look at the ruling, they decided to grant statehood to the Palestinian. And we all know that is not the case. Maybe it will be in the future, but as of today, Palestine is not a state. What we saw, it's part of the diplomatic terrorism of the Palestinian Authority. And unfortunately, the court, not yet, it's not decided finally yet, but the way it goes to that the court is collaborating with the Palestinian Authority, trying to blame Israel. And I want to remind you and the audience, Israel is the only strong democracy with strong legal institutions in the region. So I don't think what we saw coming from the ICC is intended to help anyone. It just intended to embarrass Israel.
Well, there are several things at play here. One, the UN has recognized Palestine as a state for these purposes years ago. And to some extent, the fact that the West Bank is occupied is certainly a reason that plays into the justification by the ICC for investigating potential crimes, no?
So when you look at the allegations themselves, they mainly come from the conflict we had in the border with Gaza, when we had terrorists trying to storm into Israel, and we blocked them. And that's what we expect our boys and girls in the IDF to do, to protect our civilians from terrorists. And I don't think you should judge democracies for protecting their civilians. So we are not afraid from any inquiry or any investigation. But when we see something that smells, that is coming from a political decision, they're not looking for justice. And I think there is no place to indict Israel in this court.
And of course, Israel is not the only entity that could be investigated based on this ruling. Hamas could be investigated in this ruling. But what we see here is the UN Security Council, the General Assembly, and the International Court of Justice all have affirmed that Israeli settlements are a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. So this isn't just about the 2014 war. But Amnesty International has accused Israel of war crimes and, quote, directly and deliberately targeting civilians or civilian objects in the 2014 war. That includes killing 2,251 Palestinians, 1,462 of whom were civilians, and 551 of whom were children. Now, I think you would probably argue that Hamas should be investigated, but why not Israel as well?
I think you have to look back at the origin of this discussion. It is not about the West Bank. When you look at what happened in 2005, when Israel decided to pull out from Gaza completely, we uprooted all the Jewish communities. You don't have any single settlement or so-called occupation in Gaza today. But still, we saw what happened there with Hamas. They are sending rockets and missiles to our cities. And yes, we will defend our people if we will have to do it.
You say that you left Gaza in 2005. True, but Gaza is still controlled by land, air, sea, The Arrow Sphere, the population registry, all still controlled by Israel. It still satisfies the conditions for occupation.
I don't accept this assumption, Mark. Yes, we have a border with Gaza, but I want to remind you, and you know the fact very well, that there's a border also between Egypt and Gaza. So why don't you ask the Egyptians about the occupation of Gaza?
We can talk about, and I'd be happy to have you back to talk about what's happening at the Rafah border as well. But let's assume that that's a crime as well. Let's stipulate that for a moment. That still wouldn't negate the argument that what's happening on the Israeli side is a crime. More than half of the people killed were civilians. How is that not a war crime?
Because when you look at the intentions of self-defense, and when you see what we were doing, defending our borders. And by the way, I want to remind you that people were incited to storm the fence, to try to infiltrate into Israel, and we will not allow it, and we cannot allow it. Imagine that you had people coming from the border of Mexico trying to force their way into the U.S. You will not allow it also. So I think when you look at the intentions, our boys and girls in the IDF, their intention is not to harm anyone. We have a moral army, and we are proud of it. And when there are mistakes done, we know how to investigate them. And if we need to punish, we do punish those people who were not obeying orders. But when you look at the rule of law in Israel, also in the military, you understand that the intention is to protect our civilians, not to hurt anyone.
That's an interesting argument. Of course, yes, if people were coming from the southern border in the United States, if a large number of civilians were killed, we would want to investigate it to see if, to your point, the proper intention was displayed and if the proper tactics and strategies were displayed. Would you agree that...
But who would investigate it, Mark? Let me ask you. The U.S. will allow the ICC to investigate the troopers on the border? No, it will be done in the U.S., by the U.S. court, and you will respect the decision. That's what I'm asking you today.
Yeah, so Danny, the argument, the
answer, system.
So there's two questions here. One would be, would they? And the other would be, should they? So to your point, absolutely. The U.S. probably would not agree to that, but they should. I was reading one report from Human Rights Watch on the 2014 war. They found that an Israeli missile strike on the Bereij refugee camp blew the roof off of a vehicle and partly disemboweled a 9-year-old girl and wounded her 8-year-old sister, who were sitting in front of their home nearby. And what's most interesting about that report is that they found that there was no evidence of a military objective in the vehicle or in the area at the time. Would you agree that that is something that shouldn't happen, that that constitutes a war crime?
So you know what I told my colleagues at the UN? Every time they came with me with allegations, and usually it was lies, I told them, give me the exact details of the incident, and we have the mechanism to investigate it. If one of our pilots made a mistake, we will investigate it. We will look into it. And you know, most of the times when I ask for the actual documents, we never received it.
So how many Israeli soldiers have been convicted through this process?
By the way, you will be surprised to know that when we found out that people were not obeying the rules, that they were convicted.
How many?
They paid the price.
How many, sir?
I don't want to give you a number, but I can speak about the mechanism that people in Israel went to jail because they were not obeying orders.
Well, but so you do understand.
The overwhelming majority of Israeli soldiers, they act according to the moral code of the IDF. We do whatever is necessary to save lives.
If an investigation were done and it were determined that Israel were using disproportionate force or targeting civilian populations or cutting off resources that international law says people should get, you would support condemning that if that were to happen?
I would support allowing us to do the investigation, and that's what we are doing, and that's what is respected by the international community. But if you want to play the blame game...
No, that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking if it were determined... Sorry, but I'm asking a very specific question. If it were determined that disproportionate force were used, that civilians were targeted, or that resources were cut off, like fuel, electricity, etc., you would condemn that, would you not?
Determined by whom?
By you. If you determine that, sir, I'm asking, if you determine that, would you condemn it?
Absolutely.
Okay, the reason I'm asking is because on Facebook in 2011, you wrote, "I am currently in Ashkelon to witness the security problem facing the city to deal with Hamas leaders in Gaza. And for every missile that falls in our southern towns, we retaliate by deleting a neighborhood in Gaza, by deleting a neighborhood in Gaza." You also said, "We have to stop the entry of fuel and electricity to Gaza immediately." And of course, for those that don't know, to do these things, to deny access to these types of resources or to blow up or delete entire neighborhoods, would be collective.
Allow me to answer that, Mark.
I'd love for you to answer, sir.
2011.
I want you to answer, sir, but I want to be clear to the audience, for those that don't know, as I'm sure you do know, that this would constitute collective punishment, which would be a war crime and would be a violation of international law.
So let me answer that. When Hamas is deliberately targeting electricity facilities in Israel, and threatening our lives, there is no reason for us to allow them to continue that. And that's what we were actually considering to do. So yes, when Hamas is taking advantage of civilian population, there will be a price to pay in Israel and in Gaza.
So under that circumstance, collective punishment for you is acceptable?
You know that we actually provide electricity into Gaza.
And, no, but my question is...
facility. I want to answer you that.
Oh, please.
When the same facility in Ashkelon that we use to provide electricity into Gaza is targeted by Hamas rockets and missiles, I don't think we should continue to supply electricity to Gaza on that day and time when we were under attack.
But you also talked about deleting entire neighborhoods, sir. Surely you understand that that would be disproportionate force. Do you regret that remark? Would you like to restate or take that remark back?
Absolutely not. I beg to disagree with you about, you say, disproportional. What is disproportional?
It would be deleting an entire neighborhood.
When you have hundreds of thousands of Israeli children who cannot sleep at night. I said it very clearly, and I will repeat it. If the Israeli children in Ashkelon, Ashdod, and Tel Aviv will not be able to sleep at night, also the children in Gaza will not be able to sleep at night.
Wow.
That's when you have a war time. That's when you have a war, you take action. We don't want to be there. But if Hamas will send rockets into our cities, we will retaliate. And the consequences, the unfortunate consequences will be that the children, not only in Israel, will not be able to sleep, but also the children in Gaza. But we want to avoid it. And you don't want to speak about it. In order to avoid it, we have to speak about the peace we are doing with the moderate Arab countries in the region. We have to speak about the PA that is avoiding negotiations. They care about speaking about the past, and they continue with the rejectionism.
Well, sir, I think you've definitely made a case for the ICC here, but the audience will be able to make its own determination. Let's talk about those deals in the region that you just talked about. You know, they've often been touted as peace deals, but in many ways, they're not really peace deals. The Trump administration made a plan for Israel-Palestine that didn't consult Palestinians. The Palestinian Authority has been very clear that they weren't even consulted in the deal. And then the deals that you're talking about with the UAE, with Bahrain, with Sudan, with Morocco, they had nothing to do with Palestine, of course. These and we call them peace deals, yet they were never at war with Israel during, you know, in this era. So are these deals actually peace deals, or are they just politics as usual?
So I beg to disagree with you again, Mark. It's happening a lot today. But first of all, those are a real peace deal. And by the way, Sudan and Morocco did participate in wars against Israel. They sent troops in the past.
I said in this era. Surely you wouldn't argue that Morocco has been a military threat to Israel in our lifetimes, right?
Yeah, but you can attack Israel in different venues. And I think it's important that we have normalization with those important countries.
Okay.
And we should thank the U.S. for helping it. I do agree with you. With the Palestinians, we have to negotiate with them directly. I said it for many years. We respect all mediators. We respect the U.S., the EU, the UN, you name it. But at the end of the day, it will require strong leadership from Israel and the Palestinian Authority sitting together in a room, negotiating. If you want to actually move forward, sit down and negotiate directly with us.
Danny Dannon, thank you so much. Always good to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Last August, Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny was poisoned with a nerve agent and fell into a coma. It's widely believed the Russian authorities are behind the attempt on his life, a claim the Kremlin denies. For 5 months, Navalny remained in Germany, where he had been undergoing treatment, and in January, returned home to Russia. He was immediately detained, and days later, protests erupted throughout the country. Navalny now faces more than 2 years in a penal colony, while human rights organizations and leaders across the world have condemned the ruling and recognized the Vladimir Putin challenger as a political prisoner. With Navalny's arrest, has the opposition movement come to an end? Or do recent protests indicate that it's only just the beginning? Joining me to discuss this are, from Croatia, Garry Kasparov, former world chess champion and chairman of the Human Rights Foundation, and from Moscow, Nina Khrushcheva, professor of international affairs at the New School and senior fellow of the World Policy Institute. Thank you both for joining me in the arena. Garry, I'm going to start with you. Alexei Navalny has been the Russian president's fiercest challenger for years. He's been called the man Vladimir Putin fears the most. Putin doesn't even like to say this person's name, if you can help it. He had to know when he comes home he's going to be immediately arrested. Why choose jail over exile?
That was his personal choice. I don't think we should now discuss the validity of this choice. A lot of people, myself included, thought that, you know, it could be probably more effective to stay abroad in exile, go around, help with sanctions, meet foreign leaders. But it was an act of heroism. He knew that he would be detained, arrested, and he wasn't sure, you know, how many years, not months, he would spend in prison. But he also thought that coming back, he would have a much stronger case for the protesters. And he was not wrong. After his arrest and conviction, hundreds of thousands of Russians made to the streets, and it was the biggest protest, both geographically and energetically, Russia saw since the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Nina, what do you make of this? And again, I don't want to get at the legitimacy of the choice as much as the logic, the political strategy behind, and perhaps the ideological strategy behind his choice to choose jail over exile. Why do you think he makes that choice?
Well, Alexei Navalny is a politician. And so as a politician, his name, his place is in the country he argues for politics in. If he is abroad, he just becomes one of politicians in exile. He becomes a political analyst, somebody who can analyze whatever the situation in Russia is. But he's a player. I think what he did with coming back is not only invigorating the protests, but also make everybody united in what they're protesting for, because Russia has been protesting for years, but they've never been on one subject. They would be more localized protests. But this time it is for free Navalny and Putin is a thief. So these are very, very two kind of important messages. But another thing that he has done, he put himself in the same position as Putin is. And this is really quite a feat, because Putin is the politician of Russia, and he's no longer that. Now Navalny is the politician of Russia, and Putin is just a president who needs to be replaced.
Garry, this idea that Navalny is now one of the chief players, if not the chief player, in Russia, for some, that played out in the streets. As you said, tens of thousands of people took to the streets in protest soon after his arrest. 10,000 were arrested in over 109 cities around the country. Was this about Navalny's status? Was this about Navalny, or was this more of an anti-Putin move?
Probably both, because you needed Navalny to expose Putin's corruption. And even if you have so much energy of protest, someone has to ignite it. And Navalny's act, heroic act of coming back and releasing this movie on Putin's palace, that was this trigger. So Navalny triggered the protests that had been accumulated. If you look at the demographics of the protests, you also will see the dramatic difference. 70%+ of those who filled Russian streets, 35 or years old or younger. That means that these people were even, you know, born in post-Soviet Russia or in the last few years of the Soviet Union. They never visited, they never attended Soviet school. It's a new generation. And the fact is that these people made to the streets, supported Navalny, expressed their dissatisfaction and anger with Putin's corruption, it's a sign that the regime is now in the state of agony. But the agony may take quite a long time, because, you know, it's this regime could be identified with a dinosaur, as a huge body and very small brains, and when it dies, you know, it could cause a lot of damage for those who are nearby.
In 2017 and 2018, there were protests in the streets against corruption, against the change in the retirement law, making the pension age higher. These were protests that took to the streets as well. You're there now in Moscow, in the streets. What's different now than before?
Well, I mean, before it did feel localized. I mean, people would go, and actually they were larger protests than they were this year. They were larger in numbers, but they were never, as I said, they were never that centered around a particular theme. So I think that is different. But now there is visible anger that I didn't experience before, just because I think the way Navalny is treated, it was the scene of madness, the way the state is dealing with Navalny's case, not mentioning his name, when there is a, I actually tried to get to the trial on February 2nd for him jumping parole because he was in a coma in Germany. And I couldn't get through. I mean, it was completely impossible because everything was blocked. So it feels like the city is occupied. And it also makes people angry. Of course, the state wants to do it, to kind of occupy the street and close the subway stations and close the center, because it wants people to feel very annoyed with what Navalny is, because he creates inconvenience. But I was talking to people in the street, and they were saying, that's okay, it's okay. I'm not going to go shopping in the central market this weekend. I'm going to go in 2 months when Navalny is free. So in some ways, they're creating the opposite reaction. And I think that exasperates the state much more. If it were just handled the Navalny case, that would be any other case of somebody who they say jumped parole.
Gary, let's talk about Navalny as a figure. You mentioned, both of you have sort of talked about how his recent set of choices have made him more of a heroic figure and have shifted, maybe even elevated him in the public imagination. That's certainly true. But he's not just somebody who's against corruption. He also has some pretty controversial views of his own. You look on YouTube and you see him talking to his audience about how to get rid of immigrants, comparing them to, I believe, flies and cockroaches. And of course, he was talking about in the North Caucasus region, which is predominantly Muslim. In a pro-gun rights video, he pretended to shoot one immigrant with a pistol. So when people start comparing him to Nelson Mandela, when people sort of make him a political martyr or a hero to that proportion, what do you make of it?
You're talking about certain videos and views Navalny expressed a long time ago. And I know him for nearly 20 years, and I could saw this evolution. Now, speaking about Nelson Mandela, let's not forget that, you know, before being jailed, Nelson Mandela was involved in armed resistance, violent resistance. I'm not here to downgrade the importance of this resistance against apartheid regime, but it's I think any comparison, you know, using the parallels, historical, or comparing different countries, these parallels would be lame. Even lately, you know, Navalny expressed certain views that, you know, I disapproved. We disagree on, for instance, on Crimea, on Crimean issue. But I don't think it matters, because if you look at the overall picture and Navalny's recent statements over the last few years, he was attacking the very foundation of Putin's regime. But I think that it's right now trying to pick up certain of his controversial statements of the past.
Well, just to be clear, that's exactly what
Russian propaganda is doing.
Well, it's not just Russian propaganda. In The Guardian in April of 2017, which is only less than 4 years ago, he said that he didn't regret it. He says he's unapologetic. He sees those videos, quote, as a strength that he can speak to both liberals and nationalists. And when speaking about comparing migrants to cockroaches, he said it was artistic license. And when asked specifically if there's anything at all from those videos or that period that he regrets, he firmly said no.
Okay, bad news. As I said, I knew him for nearly two decades, and I saw his evolution. It's most of the things he said they were said in before. Yes, it's even after 2014, he expressed certain views that would be not acceptable by me and many of my allies and friends. But right now we are facing an existential threat, not only to future of Russia, but the future of the world.
I would be very careful paint Navalny one way or another, because Russia is a complex country. So when we say that he is because he was had some certain views that we disapprove of in liberal America, it doesn't mean he's not popular among the Russians. In fact, I believe that his popularity in many ways is precisely because he's not a carbon copy of what we understand as liberal. So he can embrace a lot of views. And I think that is important for Russia because generally, I'm not saying all of it, but generally Russia is more conservative and much less politically correct or not politically correct at all than the United States. But another threat that Putin faces from Navalny is that when people start speaking and thinking freely and picking their politicians, because that's what Navalny does with his smart voting, that is the threat that Putin cannot take because he plans, I think, to die in the Kremlin.
Gary, Nina, thank you so much for joining me. That's our show. Up Front, we'll be back next week.